Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are...
Devinder Hardwar.
And Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show, everyone. What we're going to do here this week on the Slash Filmcast today is we are going to talk about some what we've been watching. We got a Slash Film Court today where we're going to adjudicate a movie-related dilemma, and then we're going to conclude with an in-depth review. This week, we're going to be reviewing the new Blumhouse horror film, Happy Death Day, with special guest actor Stephen Tobolowsky. And if you know the plot of Happy Death Day and you know the plot of Groundhog Day, you'll understand why that is the delightful pairing. But find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Before we start this episode, I do have an announcement to make. Now, you guys may know that I recently started, or not recently, like 5 years ago, I started doing this thing where I record 1 second of video for every day of my life using the 1 second every day app. Have you guys heard of this app or ever used it,
Jeff? I think you're doing it too. Oh,
you're doing it?
Yeah. Jeff? I did it last year and I'm doing it this year again. I was very pleased to do it the year that we found out we were having a kid, and it had my 1 second that we're, you know, even at the hospital having my son. And now this year, it's basically all Jack. It's all my son. So I'm very excited. I do it based on the calendar year. So at the end of December, I'll be compiling my final thing. But man, I can't recommend that app enough. It's a joy.
It's a great app. And I used it this year to put together my 1 second video. So this is the fifth year that I've been doing it. And putting together your 1 second video, it's like a 5 minute compilation, 5 or 6 minute compilation of your year, basically. You kind of put 1 second for every day of your year, smash it all together into one video that's 5 or 6 minutes. And, there's a few goals for doing that. Like, I think Cesar Kuriyama, the guy who basically created that app, he said during his TED Talk that, after 10 years, like after a decade, you'll have like a 1 hour movie that represents a decade of your life, which I think is like a profound thing, especially if you have children or you want to have like descendants. You can kind of pass it on as like, hey, this is a kind of like way to represent what my life was like.
It's a compression of time that feels like magic.
Yeah.
To see a year of your life in highlights. You don't think a second is very long, but it can convey a lot, and it's actually very watchable to watch these seconds smashed up one next to the next.
Yeah, especially when if you're recording the seconds, like if you have storytelling in mind when you're doing it, it can be possible to tell really interesting stories using the 1 seconds. But anyway, I put together my 1 second this year. I usually do it on my birthday, but I was very late this year. I put it together a few months later. And I made a rather startling realization as I was putting it together this year, which is that in the past 9 months, I have been sick 5 times. I got the flu, I got sinus infection, I got viral gastroenteritis, I got all these other things that happened to me in the last 5 months. And that was shocking to me because I usually get sick once a year. How often do you guys get sick? Like, I get sick like once a year, it lays me out for a week, and then I'm back to work.
It depends. But, yeah. Maybe twice.
Yeah, twice. Yeah, and so getting sick 5 times in a year felt to me like a red flag. felt like a warning, like something terrible is happening. And to be fair, I've for those curious, I've seen a doctor. I've gotten blood tests. Everything is fine.
Are you washing your hands, David?
Probably not enough. Probably not enough. So there's nothing like seriously wrong with my health. You know, I've gotten tests of all kinds, and but I am just very concerned about my own immune system and my own stress level. This past summer was extremely stressful for me. I started a new job. I was running three podcasts. And I moved out of my apartment where I'd been in for years. Not to mention, Seattle was enveloped in this haze of smoke for several weeks. It was just like a miserable time overall, and it really affected my health in a bad way. Mm-hmm. So all that said, I'm basically announcing that I'm taking a break from the Slash Filmcast, taking a couple months off of the show to kind of recuperate and to kind of unplug a little bit and focus on my full-time job a little bit, focus on the rest of my life when I'm not online a little bit. And that's the plan. So my plan is I'm going to leave the show in the extremely capable hands of Jeff Kanata and Devinder Hardwar for the next couple months and return, hopefully, triumphantly, hopefully, for Star Wars The Last Jedi, because you guys know...
Well, we know who The Last Jedi is now.
Apparently. So, apparently, perfect. I've heard it's... Well, I don't want to say, because Jeff Kanata, you probably don't know, right?
It's you, Dave.
We were thinking it's you, Dave.
Oh, it's me. It's me.
You are the Last Jedi.
Ah, that's good to know. But yeah, random side note about Last Jedi. I did not watch the newest trailer, and it was painful to do that. Like seeing everyone talk about it and celebrate it. Jeff, I mean, you got to admit that was tough.
Not an easy lifestyle, Dave. But it's.
I mean, guys, it'll all be gifted and tweeted at you. So
it was. It was.
Yeah. Indeed. So there you go. You'll get all the bits anyway.
Anyway. So I leave the show in your very capable hands for the next couple months. You know, I've been doing this show for over 9 years, pretty much every single week. I feel like I've missed maybe, 4 to 5 weeks out of that whole time.
Yeah.
And the weeks I have missed, I've like done a bonus episode or something. Yeah. So I've been doing this show for
been
really
going
long.
Surprisingly steady, man. Yeah. Like, yeah, most podcasts don't have that.
Yeah. All that said, in that time, one thing we've learned is that the show, in my opinion, generally functions better if it has three co-hosts, right? So we put out the call last week for a lot of your suggestions for guests, and we received a lot of them, and we are reading them and taking them seriously, and we really appreciate you guys sharing them with us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And we're going to try to make an effort every week that I'm gone to have on a guest, hopefully that you guys sent in, but at least someone who's a friend of the show. And so, again, appreciate all the suggestions. We're going to try to get a third chair on every single week while I'm gone. You know, by the time I'm back, you guys will be like, Dave Chen, who's that guy? We already are thrilled with the show without him. In any case, I think that's the plan is, you know, I'll be gone for a couple months and we'll be have awesome guests come in and fill in for me during that time whenever you are able to get someone on. Because it's not always like the schedules don't always work out, but there'll be a good faith effort in that part. And
I'm a little disappointed, Dave, just because I feel like there's enough now going on to really justify a weekly Avatar 2 update segment every episode. And I feel like you're just kind of missing out on that and maybe sabotaging it. Maybe that's the Jeff, real motivation here.
You know, Jeff, I was tweeting with you about Avatar this weekend. And here's the thing that I feel badly about the Avatar thing is – for me, it's one of my favorite segments, you know, hearing you defend Avatar. And it's kind of a fun thing, you know, like me and Devinder trash either Avatar or its memory and you defend it. And that's kind of a long-term thing. But I feel that this battle is starting to wear on you, Jeff. Is it starting to wear on you? Because I feel like there's a lot of earnestness in your defense of Avatar.
Let's say that one of us is tapping out and the other one is still here, Dave. So
that's fair enough.
But there's so much news, man. Kate Winslet. We could have a segment every single week talking about casting news and what's Jim Cameron thinking today.
Well, I will let you guys. You know, I'll let you guys decide how to take what directions to take the show in. How about that? Okay, you can do all that while I'm gone. Maybe just get it all out of your system, Jeff. And then we never need to talk about it again. Anyway, thanks for understanding, listeners. And I just want to say that it's been obviously so much fun doing this show. And I'm going to be back in a couple months. And then, you know, we'll see where things go from there. But I'm very grateful also to Jeff and Devinder for being willing to kind of take things over in my absence. And so that's what's going on with the show, and hope that all makes sense. And if you want to follow my stuff while I'm gone, I'll be at davechen.net. I'm going to try blogging a little bit more, try tweeting a little bit less. And so that'll be my plan for the next couple months. So,
and please continue sending in suggestions for guests, because it's very useful for us. And we'd like to expand our, you know, our purview into people we may not be personally familiar with. I think it'd be fun to have more different voices on the show.
Yeah. And send it to /filmcast@gmail.com. Don't connect us on Twitter, because it's always super awkward.
Yeah.
It's not easy. Yeah.
It's rough. But Dave, just want to say, I hope you get some rest, man. I have to say, I don't know if you're taking a break from any of your other shows. I don't know if we should take this a little personally. But
no,
yes, maybe
I will not. I will not be podcasting at all for the next couple months. So,
yes, you shouldn't be running three podcasts and a full-time job at a, you know, giant internet corporation. So, yeah, take some time. Take it easy. Hopefully you can, like, get some rest and recharge, man.
I appreciate that, guys. Well, thanks so much. But let's get on with the show. So let's talk about what we've been watching this week. I want to talk about the confession tapes real quickly. Now, I went over to a friend's house, and they had gotten a new LG OLED TV. This thing is gorgeous, like 65 inches large, and I don't have an OLED TV. so, you know, I don't even know if I prefer OLED. I think, like, the black colors are a lot darker on an OLED TV, right? Like, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. Like, they do, like, the HDR, the high dynamic range, better on an OLED TV. But, you know, I'm happy with it. I have a plasma, and we have a 4K upstairs. Very happy.
Speaking
with
of OLED, by the way, for you, Dave, and everyone else, the prices are once again falling like insane. So if you want an OLED, the 55 and the 65 inches just dropped by like $500 to $800. So now's the time. Yeah.
All right.
Get those inky blacks.
Inky blacks.
Indeed. So I go over to my friend's house, and I turn on the television. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. We start watching stuff, and instantly I realize that the True Motion setting is on by default, which is awful. And even, you know, fortunately, my friends are savvy enough to understand that something was wrong with the image, but they just didn't necessarily know to turn it off. So I turned it off for them. Things looked a lot better. And in order to kind of demonstrate how good the TV could look, I went to Netflix, and I was like, I need to find something 4K to see, or something high quality to see, like, what this TV will look like. And so I just selected one of the first things I saw, which was the confession tapes. And I started watching it, and I realized it took place in Washington, so in, like, Bellevue area, which is about 5-10 miles away from where I'm sitting right now. And I thought, I recognized that B-roll in that documentary, the confession tape. So anyway, I turned off True Motion, felt really good about myself, and I would recommend it, like, to anyone. LG's, like, leaving True Motion on by default is monstrous. And if you have a chance, go to your friends' houses and turn off True Motion.
And for those TVs, and I think most TVs, it's also a separate setting on every individual picture setting.
Yes.
So you have to actually...
Yes. You got to go in, like, one by one and turn
it
off.
Well, either do that. They usually have a setting to just say, apply this to everything, and you have to make sure to do that. But yeah, it'll occasionally pop back up, like, after the TV updates or something, too. It's super annoying.
I will say, if you're watching NFL on Sunday, leave the True Motion on. It's great. Literally anything else, turn it off. But it's great for sports.
It's awesome for sports. It's true.
It's fine for stuff like that. But if we, like, once we're getting sports streamed in, like, actual 60 FPS and not make believe 60 FPS, you know, at that point, then you could also turn it off. That's the whole appeal, right? It's trying to make it smoother, as if you were looking at, like, nice 60 FPS video. And you can see some examples of that on YouTube. It looks amazing, like some of that nature photography.
Agreed. So anyway, I was watching the confession tapes, and I thought, oh my gosh, that show looks kind of good. It's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original series, kind of a true crime series of documentaries, very Errol Morris inspired in terms of its style. And so I decided to watch the first couple episodes, and this is an incredibly depressing show, guys. But it does,
right up your alley.
It does answer the following question, which is, how is it that people can confess to crimes they didn't commit? And the movie doesn't necessarily, or I should say the show doesn't necessarily present definitive answers, but it does answer the question of how that could happen. It presents several different cases, each of which, like, plausibly the person confessed to a crime they didn't commit. And it happens in a different way in every story, right? Like, it's not just like police berating them in an interrogation room. And that's how it happens every single time. Like, the cases are all different in terms of how the confessions were kind of coerced or drawn out of people in different ways. And I thought it was completely fascinating. But you should not watch it if you want to continue having faith in our society's institutions. So all that said, The Confession Tape is a great-looking show, and it raises really troubling questions about false confessions in our justice system.
You know, Dave, that show sounds great. Not sure if that sounds like a great 4K HDR demo.
It's true. It's a good looking show. It's a good looking show, but it's not. It's, you're right. I wish they had like Mad Max Fury Road. Yeah.
In that respect, by the way, if you're looking for a good thing that's on Netflix, the first episode of Daredevil, that scene where they enter his apartment for the first time, and it's kind of lit from the back by the neon lighting outside and it's dark inside. That is a great HDR demo. And also the night fight in the rain. Like, I just show that to people when they come over and I'm like, oh, what is OLED look like? And they're like, oh, that's the difference. And the difference with 4K HDR too. So check that out.
I always use that. What's that food show on Netflix?
Chef's Table?
No, the other one about like the history of food. It's the first episode starts in the like outback in Australia.
Oh, is that one just called Food?
It might be. I can't remember. But
the Michael Palin one.
It's amazing. And it's the photography, and they like set fire to the fields, and it's spectacular.
So the opening of Sense8, which Sense8 isn't an HDR show, but it's just like so well shot.
Cooked.
Yes.
Cooked. Right.
That show looks good. But yeah, the opening of Sense8, not HDR, but shot so beautifully and looks so clear, like in 4K. Like, there's a lot of good demo stuff on Netflix.
I'm kind of in a place right now where the TVs we have are really good enough. You know, like I have a 50-inch plasma TV that I bought 5 years ago, which is depreciated in price by like 50 to 70%.
Probably.
But
more.
I got no complaints.
You drive
about
it off a lot, Dave. As soon as you drive it off a lot.
But I got no complaints about it. You know, like when I moved to Seattle, I got a job at Microsoft. I was like, I'm buying myself a nice TV for once.
Sure.
And I got it, and it's like it was like right before the 4K craze took off, right? Mm-hmm. So now I got this 50-inch plasma. It's pretty nice, but it's like, you know, it's not bad enough that I want to upgrade, but it's not nice enough that I don't feel envious of Jeff Cannata and Devendra Hardwar, you know?
Basically, make a promise to yourself, Dave. Like, your TV actually still sounds relatively new, but just go OLED. Like, just wait until OLED is cheap enough for you. And I think that's the best way to kind of time it out.
All right.
Yeah, by that time, there'll be something better. That's how it works.
Indeed.
I don't know. Jeff, I know you have regrets. I'm very sorry.
I have regrets.
Next time, let me know. And
Jeff, what are your regrets? So did you buy your 80-inch TV? Your 80-inch TV is 4K, though, right?
It is, but it's not HDR.
Oh.
And that is
literally a critical mistake. One year before they retroactively added HDR to the Vizio model that I have. So I literally missed it by that much.
It
kills me every day. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of that.
Champagne problems.
That's true.
I think Dan Trachtenberg used to use that expression.
Indeed.
Okay. So I also had a chance to go to the Bend Film Festival. And it is in Bend, Oregon. It is a six-hour drive away. Me and my fiance loaded up the car, drove down to Bend. And I went there to watch my film, Dr. B, my short film, play in front of an audience. It played in a family shorts segment that was, what do you call it? It aired at 10 in the morning.
Oh, great.
And what was cool about it was it was a family shorts film. So there's a bunch of kids there, right? Mm-hmm. Which is an audience that would never otherwise watch this movie. Like, even if this movie did huge gangbusters on like Vimeo or something, I don't know that, you know, kids would ever find it. Like my short film Dr. B, which you can find
online. It's like yo-yos.
Yeah, it's a yo-yo movie, you know, but it's not a movie that I think, like, I don't know, I didn't think of it as a family film when I created it. And it was when you submit to a film festival, you don't know what is going to happen to your film. Like, you don't know if it's going to be paired up with a feature-length movie. You don't know if it's in a shorts program. Like,
In a film festival, anything that doesn't have aggressive nudity and language is a family film.
Yeah, indeed. But you know, you don't know like what's going to happen to your, like, you don't know what it's going to be paired with, is what I'm saying. And I would say I was very pleasantly surprised. I've you know, been on film festival juries before multiple times, and a lot of short films can be pretty rough. And I was pleasantly surprised that, like, pretty much every, you know, there was some range of quality, but most of the shorts were really awesome. And there was actually one short that was extraordinary. It was called Just Go. It was directed by Pavel Gumennikov. It was a Latvian short film, and the plot summary is a young man who lost both legs in a childhood accident comes to the rescue of the girl next door. This dude who had lost both of his legs, like his neighbor, his female neighbor, has her purse snatched, and the dude is able to like chase down the thieves and like apprehend them without any legs. And it's the most incredible thing I've ever seen on screen. So anyway, that short film was amazing.
Is it an action movie?
Yeah, it's kind of like an action short film. But with a guy who is differently abled than most people.
It's like Blind Fury, but for legs.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch. So I'd highly recommend it. I don't know if it's available right now, but it's called Just Go, and it's directed by Pavel Gumennikov. And I'll just say, you know, one other word about seeing my short film projected on a big screen. It's an awesome experience. You know, like seeing your short film engaged with, seeing people laugh at it, seeing people react to it. It sounds trite and sounds, you know, maybe slightly silly, but it made the 6-hour drive worth it, you know?
Yeah.
Even though nice. The short film is only 8 minutes long. mm-hmm. But, you know, it wasn't like we just went to see the short film. We also went hiking and we met some people there at the Bend Film Festival. So it was a great time. It was an awesome little festival. I mean, it's in terms of length and scope, you know, I think it lasts like three or four days, whereas the Seattle Film Festival lasts like 25 days. So it's not a huge festival, but the programming is awesome, and it's great to be kind of out in nature in a beautiful place. So I'd recommend it if you're around the area. I also want to point out that a Slash Filmcast listener named Seth came out, I assume, just to say hi and meet me, because I don't know that he would have gone to the family shorts at 10 a.m. on Saturday otherwise. but he did come up and said he was a big fan. And so, Seth, appreciate you saying hi. Appreciate you coming out to the festival. So, okay. All that said, I did have a chance to watch a movie called Mr. Roosevelt. Have you guys heard of this movie?
No.
This is a movie directed by Noelle Wells, who, if you don't know who that is, she was on Master of None Season 1. She played Aziz Ansari's character's girlfriend. I think she was on Saturday Night Live for like a season. And she wrote and directed this movie called Mr. Roosevelt, which I thought was delightful. It actually won the special jury prize or something at the Bend Film Festival for narrative fiction. It's a very funny, very touching movie about Noelle Wells' character, who's kind of like a version of Noelle Wells, going through like this quarter-life crisis, going back home after a long time away in Los Angeles, trying to make it in the show business. And I thought it was very funny, very astutely observed. It played at South by Southwest, and I assume that you'll be able to see it at some point. But wanted to give a shout-out to Mr. Roosevelt, written and directed by Noah Wells. I thought it was hilarious. So that's what I've been watching this week. Went to Bend Film Festival, saw the documentary, The Confession Tapes. Devendra Hardwar, what have you been watching this week?
Oh, I've been checking out this new series on Netflix called Mindhunter. And this is not to be confused with Manhunter or Manhunt. I think that's the other one.
No, there is actually an extremely terrible movie called Mindhunters.
Yes. Oh, there's that too.
A 2004 movie directed by Rennie Harlan, which is an atrocious movie. Atrocious.
Rennie Harlan.
Yeah.
This show, it's not. It's produced and a couple episodes are directed by David Fincher, which is what really got me on board. But it's created by Joe Pennell, who wrote the screenplay for The Road, I believe, and a couple other films recently. It is set in the 70s, and it's about two FBI agents who are basically sort of like at the early stages of investigating criminal science and forensics and psychology and things like that, like just figuring out how serial killers think as like the nature of crime was changing. And in many ways, this movie, this show feels like a successor to a Zodiac, just in terms of like the process of it and how it dives into criminal psychology and how the law enforcement side has to deal with it. It stars Jonathan Groff, who is in Glee and a bunch of other things. Also Holt McCallany, who I love. He's a great character actor. Seeing him in a bunch of things, but also nice to see him reuniting with Fincher after Fight Club and Alien 3. They're a great pair. They're sort of like it's a buddy cop thing. McKinley is the older cop. Jonathan Groff is the younger one, who's like really eager to learn all this stuff. And it's really them like just going, traveling around the country, trying to teach law enforcement about these new techniques, while also maybe solving some of the more crazier crimes there. And the show looks amazing, at least the two episodes I've seen from Fincher so far. And just it's well written. Like it feels like a good Netflix show. It's not astounding, but it's really fun to watch. And it's the sort of thing that will compel you to keep watching. I've talked to several people who've finished this entire series over the last weekend. It's very bingeable. And I really enjoyed it. So I think, Dave, in particular, you will like it. Like, it's very Fincher-esque. Really dives into the FBI stuff really well in terms of, like, how they do their jobs. And the scenarios, the, like, serial killer scenarios here are just so messed up and kind of original, too. Like, I've been getting sick of this stuff, but this feels refreshing in a way. So worth checking out for sure.
All right. Well, that's Mindhunter on Netflix. Not to be confused with Mindhunters. And,
Manhunt. Which is another FBI show, I think.
Or House Hunters. Or House Hunters. Or what is that? Manhunter, right? The Thomas Harris story with Michael Mann.
Amazing. Yeah. Mindhunter actually feels like a prequel to the stuff we saw in Manhunter.
It's a sequel to Zodiac and a prequel to Mindhunter. Is Mindhunter.
Sure.
Mindhunter. Okay, I got to enunciate more. all right, that's Mindhunter on Netflix. Jeff Cannata, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I watched the Netflix original film, The Meyerowitz Stories. Meyerowitz. I don't know.
This is the new Noah Baumbach movie, right?
I love Noah Baumbach. I adore him as a filmmaker. And I am of the opinion that he's getting better. He's getting better. Like his early stuff was great. But While We're Young, I think is my favorite of his movies. And it's, I think, the most recent one he made. It was on my
Mistress
list.
Mistress America, too.
I didn't see that yet.
That's really good.
I've heard that's great. I'm really, I want to.
I
got to
watch
out.
That.
Yeah.
But I always pay attention to what he's doing. While We Were Young was on my list of favorite movies in 2014. And, you know, he's brilliant, in my opinion. And I think this movie is one of my favorites of his. It is a work of art. It's beautiful. It's got incredible performances across the board. What an amazing cast. Mm-hmm. It's crazy to me that this is a Netflix film, right? This is one Oscar worthy. I think Dustin Hoffman could easily be nominated for this performance. I think a lot of the people in this movie, honestly, could be nominated. If this was a big fall Oscar pushed kind of theatrical release, I would believe it. It feels like that kind of movie, and I adore it. It moved me. It made me laugh. It made me think. It's about a family, two brothers and a sister, all sort of from different mothers. And this patriarch, who is Dustin Hoffman, who is this sculptor of little renown, but is a giant in his own mind. And it kind of sits at this intersection between Woody Allen and Wes Anderson, right? It's kind of got that family angst of Wes Anderson, but that New York intellectual, full of themselves, Woody Allen world thing that I've always been enamored with. And I've always sort of secretly wished it was a very aspirational place for me in college. Like, I wanted to be in that world of, you know, intellectualism and our art and people who had big conversations about big topics and went from art gallery opening to new hot restaurant. You know, that world is very attractive to me. It's an amazing thing to see in films. And this, it lives right there, but it also is a tragic tale of somebody who never really achieved what they thought, and they're, and kind of passed along that failure and angst to their kids and mistreated them in very, very atypical ways, I think, very ways that you don't usually see in depicted in films. Because he thinks he's a loving father. He thinks he's a great guy, but he is sort of emotionally abusive to them in really fantastic ways. And it's an amazing thing. It stars Adam Sandler, who delivers a wonderfully nuanced and subtle performance. I don't think I've ever really seen Adam Sandler like this, even in Punch Drunk Love. Mm. This is a real step forward for him as an actor. Emma Thompson plays an amazing character in this movie. Like, she's transformed. An actress, what is her name? Elizabeth Marvel. Is that her name? Elizabeth Marvel.
The daughter?
Yeah. Who I knew from House of Cards, who is in that show such a powerhouse, such a force to be reckoned with, this like strikingly bold and take no prisoners female politician. And in this movie, she couldn't be more different than that. She's mousy and emotionally damaged and kind of withdrawn. It's just a transformation, and I was really impressed with her performance.
She's hilarious in this movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. What are your thoughts? Do you agree with Jeff on this one?
I'm not as much of a Baumbach fan, but I've warmed up to his stuff more recently. Like after. While We're Young, and I really like Francis Ha, I really like Mistress America, and I think he's just evolving in a good way. His earlier stuff definitely felt like it was stuck in this like sad intellectualism that was about broken families, and it's interesting, but it never really connected with me, and I think his newer stuff is getting better. I really enjoyed this one. It's not nearly as warm a film as something like Francis Ha or Mistress America, but it's a very like nuanced thing, and it's definitely a portrait of a family that is like broken in so many ways, and it's sort of like how they have to come together in a time of crisis, and I typically like those stories. It's a good family tale in that respect, and it's really great to see Adam Sandler doing a great dramatic role again, like after so much junk, like after all the Netflix, like his other Netflix stuff. I don't know if you guys have ever seen those things.
No.
Like the Western one. I watched that a commentary thing at some point. That was garbage. Like, it is nice to see that Adam Sandler can still do this. And yeah, the combination of, him, Ben Stiller and Elizabeth Marvel as these sort of like, as siblings who are strange and who are connected but not really connected in a close way. I think that's all pretty well done. This is the sort of story that can be tiring, though. Like, if the Woody Allen type of movie of like smart people saying things and maybe thinking they're smart but just being like obnoxious about it, there's a lot of that, but I think it's self-aware of that too. Like the Dustin Hoffman character, he thinks he has big ideas about himself. He's very narcissistic, and it is kind of, to me, it was heartbreaking to see like how he actually treated his kids and how he in a way was always competing with them. It's a complex movie, and it's kind of heartbreaking
heart
in ways.
It,
yeah,
it has real heart. It's not it's not a cold, sterile look at intellectualism. It's really a beautiful movie, in my opinion. And there's a scene. I feel like this is the movie we should have reviewed this week instead of the movie you're about to hear us review. But there's
How
a scene early on with Adam Sandler and his daughter in the film sitting at a piano playing a song that they wrote when she was 9, supposedly, in the history of the film. And it is such a beautiful, sweet, wonderful moment, this original little song. I don't know. The movie is full of unexpected gems like that. Whereas, it's harsh and it's about these people bashing heads a lot, but it's also really tender and nuanced. I just was blown away by it. It's probably going to be in my list of favorite films of the year.
I really like Adam Sandler in this too, because he plays a guy who basically devoted his life to raising his daughter too. And honestly, that's the stay-at-home father perspective. I don't think we really get to see too much in films and TV, and it's handled here in a way that, you know, he's trying to get back to work now, but it's handled respectfully in a way that I kind of appreciated.
I think Dustin Hoffman is brilliant in this movie
so good.
Too. He's, yeah.
All right. Well, that's the Meyerowitz stories. And it's available right now on Netflix, right? Streaming on Netflix. Netflix.
Yeah, it's actually it's in some theaters. So this is better than what Netflix used to do with the releases.
Cool. You know, this reminds me of like another video on demand movie. Like there's a movie I wanted to watch in time for today. I didn't get around to Brawl on Cell Block 99. Did you guys hear about this movie?
Yeah, I really want to see that too. Yeah.
This is the new movie by the guy who directed Bone Tomahawk.
I've heard divisive things, but enough to make me want to see it. So that if we have a slow week, that could be one of the things we end up watching.
Indeed.
Sorry, Dave. You're going to miss out.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I might be back for like a bonus episode. I still have, you know.
We'll see.
I still kind of am hoping that me and Matt Singer can review Geostorm at some point, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
You know, do that to yourself.
Yeah, it does look terrible. If I think that would make a hilarious bonus episode. Seeing ads for that movie after literally everything that's happened over the past couple of months seems insane, by the way. Like, just
well, I think
California's
really
on fire and Puerto Rico's still a mess and we have multiple storms. Oh, man.
They've really pivoted, I think, to the idea of like man-made. It's man-made disasters, guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's certainly not something we have familiarity with on Earth.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, anyway, that's what we've been watching this week. I want to actually take a moment to thank all the people that donated to the podcast this week. Want to thank specifically John Carr for his very generous donation and Murayama Asuka. For their donation as well. And you can always donate to the Slash Film Cast by going to slashfilm.com and clicking on the Slash Film Cast tab using the PayPal links on the side of the page. Or just go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/ and then the word filmcast. Those are some ways to donate to this podcast. And all the money you donate goes to helping us defray the cost of seeing movies, putting on the show. All that said, let's get to this week's edition of the Slash Film Court. Slash Film Court. Slash Film Court. Slash Film Court. You can't handle the truth. Out of order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. Court's adjourned. Slash Film Court. The Slash Film Court, for those of you who don't know, is our quasi-weekly segment where we adjudicate your movie-related dilemmas. Gotten a lot of Slash Film Court emails recently. A bunch of Slash Film Court emails about feet. You guys may have seen some of these about feet, like people taking their shoes off in a theater, right? We've talked about feet before. Devendra, what's your go-to action for people who take off their shoes in a theater?
I honestly, I've never seen that. And I don't know what the action is there. Because it's not like in a plane, I feel like it's worse, right? Because it is more of an enclosed environment and you're probably trapped next to this person. And people who take off their shoes on planes tend to like start sitting cross-legged and then their feet get closer to you. In a theater, I feel like that's less of an issue.
I agree. Kind of live and let live situation with the feet if it's not directly bothering you.
There are so many other smells in the theater. Like, that's the thing.
Indeed.
I was going to say I take off my shoes on planes, but it's really more that Blef Blanata guy.
Honestly, I don't.
Is that a no-no?
I actually do like taking off shoes on planes, but you got to wear socks. That's
Of course you wear socks.
The thing I keep seeing a lot is the barefoot on the plane, and then walking to the bathroom.
No.
Oh, you might as well burn your feet off.
Might as well just burn your feet off.
All right, guys.
Trouble with the feet. In theaters, just want to say, is when people put them up on the headrest.
Yeah.
Because people put
their
heads there.
Pretty bad. All right, guys. This is the real email. This one actually comes in from Neil, who actually, it looks like they private messaged the Slash Film Facebook page, which is like a very bad way of getting this to us. You really want to email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Of course, they messaged this to us a month ago. That's why we're just getting around to this, because we didn't get it until recently. And I will say that this is probably going to be one of our easier cases, guys. This one comes in from Neil in the United Kingdom. Neil writes in, Whenever me and my partner go to the cinema and one of us needs to use the bathroom during the film, we discreetly FaceTime each other so the person going to the bathroom can watch the movie as the other films films the screen. What? I personally feel there is nothing wrong with this, but after telling my friends, they tell me I'm heading down a path that could get me thrown out. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Seeing as how David is always talking about his weak bladder affliction, I feel that this would be something that would be of interest to future visits. First of all, am I always talking about my weak bladder affliction? I feel like
we all talk about the need to go to the bathroom sometimes.
I don't. That doesn't sound like me, but okay. All right. Anyway, Jeff Cannata, FaceTiming during the movie so your partner can see the movie while they're in the bathroom.
Wow.
No, how dare you? How dare you? We all make a decision, and there are repercussions for your decisions. If you decide to go and go to the bathroom, you have decided that you're not going to see, you're not going to get to see some crappy FaceTime version of what's going on in the, no. How dare you?
Yes, no. And that's really the only thing here. I can understand the need to do it, but yeah, at some point you're going to get banned from the theater just by
doing understand it. The feeling that you really feel like you're being clever and you figured this one out and you came up with a great workaround for this whole problem. No.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you are going to get there's going to be a moment where that person goes, "You're recording our movie and get out of here."
Yeah, I mean, it looks like you're filming the movie and not FaceTiming the movie. So you definitely.
I'm just FaceTiming the movie. Don't get mad at me, sir. I'm just FaceTiming the movie.
I would say that not only is this terrible faux pas for the rest of the people in the theater, but you are imperiling your ability to even go to the movies by doing this, right? I mean, they could put you on the lifetime banned list or something like that.
I want to be in the bathroom with the guy in the stall and hear the movie coming from the stall from the guy's cell phone. I want to be that dude and be like, what in the fuck is going on?
I will say that one thing this does reinforce is the need for movie theaters to pipe in audio from the movie into bathrooms more often.
Right, right.
No. Because then I'm in a movie and I'm getting spoilers. I'm in a bathroom and I'm getting spoilers from a movie.
It depends. Like if it's a theater that's in such a way that the bathroom is right next to the theater, you're actually going to.
Oh, yeah.
That
yeah.
is actually the better.
So they do this at the Cinerama in Seattle, which only has one screen. So,
right.
So you can't get spoiled for a movie that you're not watching. Yeah.
But if you had designated bathrooms for each movie, like, I'm here for The Last Jedi. Oh, you want to go to bathroom 6.
But Jeff, you say that mockingly. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Just go to the bathroom before the movie starts. It's not difficult.
Jeff, I'm surprised you are pointing this out, though, because sometimes you gotta go.
Yeah,
you
sometimes gotta go. You can't anticipate.
Blade Runner 2049 is 7 hours long. You gotta go to the bathroom.
I'm
sometimes.
An adult human who can anticipate my needs. I pee, but I've had a full bladder in a movie. I can hold it.
Let me ask you guys this. What is worse? Suffering through the full bladder, not knowing when the movie's going to end, constantly thinking about that pain and not really enjoying the movie, or running to the bathroom for like 3 minutes.
I'm with Devendra
on getting
this
back
one.
And actually enjoying the movie. I'd much rather do that.
You know what's crazy experience is I saw that movie, The Witch, the horror film, twice in theaters. And one time, the first time I had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the movie. And then I watched it a second time and I realized, oh my gosh, I'm seeing a slightly different movie than I saw last time. You know, like there's like scenes that I didn't see the first time. You know what I'm saying? Like,
only had FaceTimed it.
Yeah, I should have. All right. Anyway, thanks to Neil for writing into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. You can always write in with your /film court dilemmas to that address. Neil, stop FaceTiming your movies. It's a terrible idea. It's rude. And you're possibly going to get kicked out of the theater. So,
yeah.
All right. Nice short one. Let's get to our review of Happy Death Day.
Hey, you're up.
Look, I know this isn't going to make any sense.
Stop global warming?
Hey. I feel like I'm losing my mind.
You sneaky little biatch.
Happy birthday.
I've already lived through this day.
Somebody's going to kill me tonight.
So you can hear now.
Is everything okay?
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
That was from the trailer of Happy Death Day, the new film by director Christopher Landon. According to the plot summary on IMDb, a college student relives the day of her murder with both its unexceptional details and terrifying end until she discovers her killer's identity. This is the Slash Filmcast, and joining us today, you may have seen him in shows such as HBO's Silicon Valley, as well as Netflix's One Day at a Time. He's currently on the show White Famous on Showtime. Stephen Tobolowsky, welcome back to the Slash Filmcast. Stephen, how are you doing today?
I am feeling so good, David, and it's such a shock to the system to be back on Slash Film. It must be a special occasion.
It's a special, occasion, all right. So I want to kick this off, this review off, by reading this email written in to slashfilmcast@gmail.com by
Wadji. One of my favorite emails in recent memory.
Okay, Wadji writes in, "You guys made me watch that movie, Happy Death Day. I just came back from watching it. I only watched it because you guys said you would review it, so you better review it. I would never waste money on a PG-13 horror movie aimed at teens. I'm a 31-year-old man, and I watched this movie alone, as no one else would come with me to see this movie, because it's a PG-13 horror movie aimed at teens. I was completely uncomfortable throughout, and please review this movie or I will feel completely duped. It actually wasn't completely awful, though. Thank you kindly." So that email comes in from Wadji at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Let me say this. When I suggested this crazy idea for Stephen Tobolowsky to review Happy Death Day with us, I did not know that it was aimed at teens.
is it even really aimed at teens? I don't know.
I mean, it's a PG-13 movie, and I'll say that there was a significant contingent of teenage girls sitting behind me during my screening that really, really enjoyed the film. Anyway, I didn't know that it was aimed at teens. That being said, I think it made more money than Blade Runner in theaters this weekend.
Did it, man.
Despite costing less than $5 million to make, whereas Blade Runner cost $155 million. That said, I think we'll be talking about Blade Runner 2049 more 30 years from now than we are talking about Happy Death Day. Okay, all that said, Stephen Tobolowsky, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you is this is a movie that, let's just say, it is inspired in some way by Groundhog Day.
Lifts literally... Steals.
I want to say, can they do that?
Sure.
It's illegal for them to do this.
Stephen texted me on Saturday out of the blue, like with no context. And he just says, can they do that? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, can they just steal it without saying it? They just acknowledged it?
Well, they do say, I mean, at the end, they do acknowledge, they say, like, well, this whole thing that you just told me, is that in the spoiler category?
It's probably in the spoilers, but it's okay. They call out Groundhog Day in the actual movie itself.
And they mention Bill Murray, and she says, I never heard of him.
Right. Clearly, this is some alternate universe, right?
And he says, well, you got to see this, opening the door to their future relationship, their future relationship will be one of the first important nights in Carter's life, is going to be seeing Groundhog Day with her, and probably having a very hot makeout session afterwards with both of their clothes on because it's PG-13.
Well, Stephen, let me ask you this. Let's get to the ending of this movie later on during spoilers. But let me ask you, there have been many movies that have made use of the repeating day trope. You know, Edge of Tomorrow or Life, Live, Die, Repeat. Source Code, Time Crimes, Triangle, 1201, the Jonathan Silverman classic. You know, there's been a lot of movies that make use of this trope. And and you've seen... I assume some of these movies. None of them, in my opinion, is as good as Groundhog Day. So I guess my question for you is, what separates the good ones from the bad ones, in your opinion, if there are any good ones? And do you think Happy Death Day is one of the good ones?
I'll answer the last part first. It's an interesting question. Happy Death Day is a good one. And the reason is that in any of these kind of Groundhog Day ripoff, I didn't mean to say ripoff movie, but any of these Groundhog Day based movies, the audience is way ahead of the film, right? So they already know what the ending of the film is probably going to be in its general outline, if not its specifics, at the onset. So what I found interesting about Happy Death Day and the use of the Groundhog Day formula is that the closer they followed the formula, the more successful the film was.
Yeah, it's a good formula.
For example, when again, I don't know if this goes in the spoilers point, you could black it out. There is always in these movies the day in which she realizes she has to change her personality, like Bill Murray has to change his personality, like Tom Cruise figures like he has to change his strategy. And those days, those particular days, are always the most entertaining in those films. And it's true in this film, Happy Death Day, the day she decides to change her personality had more gotcha moments and more of the larger picture ideas that are in this movie happen on that day. And ironically, the more they strayed from the Groundhog Day formula, the more the film would fail. For example, Groundhog Day doesn't really bother to explain anything at all. Yep. And in Happy Death Day, when they explain like, oh, well, I got to go back and do this day again, or Carter's going to be in big trouble. You know, the more they try to explain the unexplainable, that there is no real reason why this day is repeating, the more the film kind of gets bogged down in false kind of logic to make it make sense. It doesn't have to make sense. And the more it doesn't make sense, the more it works.
All right. Well, Jeff Cannata, I think you had a real come to Jesus moment about seeing this movie at all. You texted us. You texted us, and you were like, "I don't, you know, if we're not 100% sure going to have Steven on to talk about this, I'm not going to see this movie." So we got Steven on. You ended up going to see it.
Yes, I did.
And so
myself in a theater, like our emailer, very similar.
Do you regret that decision, or did you find there enough quality goodness here to merit a viewing of this movie in theaters?
I would have happily lived my entire life not having seen this movie, but it also wasn't awful. You know, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't like Transformers Insult My Time style. It cannot be overstated how direct a ripoff of Groundhog Day this is. I mean, there is literally a Ned Ryerson character. There's
now,
like this.
Now, who did you think the Ned Ryerson character was?
The woman that wants her to sign the petition every time she walks out of the room, right? Oh. It's basically your character, right?
It could be. And it could be. Someone pointed that out to me, but I felt like I was so much taller than she was.
And had so much more charm.
The woman who was the irritating head of the sorority used the phrase anywho many times, which is the phrase I put in that movie, the movie we call Groundhog Day.
Your greatest contribution to cinema history, I think.
Was the word anywho.
Yes.
I said anywho, and she uses that several times, so I'm thinking, if we are taking the position of when Jessica encounters me in her repeat of the day, yes, the girl is trying to save the world would be me. But if we take the irritation factor, the fact that Ned was enormously irritating,
right,
the woman who's head of the sorority was that irritating factor that you continually have to deal with.
Interesting. No, very, very astute. Either way, it's a direct ripoff. And, and the fact that the movie calls it out does not excuse it. In fact, and this we'll have to, you know, circle back on in spoilers, but there are a couple of things actually that this movie calls out. And I'm like, no, you can't, you don't get away with that. Just, hey, it's a plot hole, but we said it. So get out of jail free card because we acknowledged it. No, I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. But I will say, I think the lead actress, who I'm sorry, I didn't have the IMDb in front of me. I didn't get her
Jessica
name.
Roth,
yeah,
who plays
Jessica
Tree
Roth.
Yeah, Tree Geldman.
Tree? Why is her name Tree? Do we know why her name's Tree?
Nope. It just
yeah, parents are hippies.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
I think she was one of the women that was like one of Emma Stone's characters' friends in La La Land in that like opening.
I think she is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think she is very charming. I think I was actually really thought she had a lovely transformation from, you know, despicable, self-absorbed to lovable and likable. You know, I think that's not an easy thing to pull off, and she did a good job at that. I actually found her very charming.
Can I throw in something quickly on Jessica?
Please.
Yeah.
I had feelings as I was watching her that she could be the woman of the future. Watching her in this film, she is an actress who is kind of angry, impulsive, not sexy, and not even likable as a character. But she carries this film so beautifully because what you said, she has the ability to transform. Mm-hmm. And become our heroine. And I'm sitting there wondering, because I happened to spend the weekend with Jessica in South Dakota. When I was just in South Dakota, at the film festival there, she was there, and they were airing another feature of hers, Tater Tot and Patton, in which she plays an angry, impulsive, not sexy, and not even likable woman, like she does in this film. But her transformation is palpable. And as an audience member, I sat in both films and I was very moved by her in both performances.
Yeah.
It was her ability to grab me and show her transformation in both of these films. And I think she's going to be a force out there. I think she's going to be the woman of the future.
Oh, that's a wonderful endorsement. Yeah. I came away feeling similarly. I really thought she was great. You know, there was a period in the, early 90s where we got like Die Hard in a blank, right? Die Hard on a boat, Die Hard on a bus.
Uh-huh.
Right? There was Die Hard in a, right? And now we're sort of getting Groundhog Day in a, or get Groundhog Day
in a college, Groundhog Day in a futuristic battlefield.
War. Yeah.
Right. And I think the conceit here is Groundhog Day in a horror film, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
But this movie
A campy horror film.
It's
not like,
barely a horror film.
Yeah.
I actually think that's a kind of an interesting idea, right? You relive the same day, you get horribly murdered at the end of the day over and over, and you have to figure out your own kill. That's a really compelling premise. It's a fun premise. But the movie just phones in so much of the horror stuff. It really doesn't care about that. It's really being Groundhog Day too much, I think, to even be remotely scary, because it's never scary. It's just, it's silly.
Slasher movie, man. But
it's not even really a slasher movie. I mean, I guess the PG-13 holds it back a little bit, but also like the deaths are never, I mean, there's a couple that are mildly interesting, but it doesn't even, it just doesn't do that half of its genre justice, I think. So I think the movie fails there. I really want to talk in spoilers about how it ends because I cry foul a little bit about that. But overall, it's kind of a trifle, and it wasn't offensive. And the charm of the lead actress kind of carried it for me. And I, you know, it was fine. But again, I could have easily gone my whole life without seeing it and not felt like I missed out.
Devendra Hardwar, what about you?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm pretty much in line with you guys. I thought it was it's a good film. It's not a great movie, and I think I could have watched this at home easily and I gotten the same effect from it. But there are things I definitely like about it. I do like Jessica Roth. It's just like a great performance. Very 90s, kind of reminded me of Sarah Michelle Gellar in Buffy in a way. There's a lot of like Whedonisms throughout. I think the script has some moments that really sparkle. It's funny. Like, it's a funny movie. Most of the cast, I think, does a good job of playing their roles, be it the, like, you know, the head of the sorority, the really annoying one. They really, and I think you learn to love to hate that character in a way too, because she is very much that character. So I had a lot of fun with the movie in that respect. I think the least fun I had with this movie is kind of the audience. It wasn't a teen audience, but I saw it in Union Square, which means I was surrounded by NYU students. And they are not the best crowd in New York movies. They're the worst. So I was surrounded by them. But my wife and I went.
What makes them the worst? Like they're texting or they're talking or?
They basically don't know how to exist in social spaces, I guess. So, yeah, there is texting. There is like obnoxious laughing at nothing, at like the dumbest things or like the really cruel things that the movie does occasionally. Or like I think there were occasional like racist jokes where like one girl sitting right next to me, even though most of the theater was empty. For some reason, everybody really wanted to get in that like one row, would just like laugh at the dumbest things or like the most racist things in the movie. Yeah, things like that. And yeah, in general, people texting, people like there was one guy that I appreciated. He dimmed his screen all the way down. So he was texting throughout the entire movie. But, you know, he tried to hide it. It wasn't like, glaring. That's respect. I give him that. That's the least I could ask for in today's like movie going environment. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I thought the movie was fun. There was a point where I thought it was going to be very dumb about how it solved this whole mystery. And I was secretly wishing to myself that it wouldn't just do it this way, and then it kind of changed things up a little in a way that you probably expect, but I appreciated that too. And I think the movie has a decent amount of heart, right? There is some emotional catharsis for this character, for what she's going through. It doesn't explain why she's going through it. I actually kind of like the internal logic that this movie built up, right? Because there's a point where I don't know if it's spoiler, but there are consequences for what's happening to her. And we never really saw that in Groundhog's Day, and certainly not like Edge of Tomorrow either. So the idea that, you know, this is happening, but it's finite and, you know, you have to solve this thing and there's a time limit to it. Just slight changes of the rules, I think, were kind of interesting. And also the idea that, oh, yeah, I did this playthrough wrong. I'm going to have to start over again because I don't want this guy to be dead. You know, those kinds of things were fun. So I thought overall it's a fun movie, a great script, and a really good lead performance.
Yeah, I'll just say a few things and then let's get to spoilers for this. I am, yeah, right there with you, kind of. Like, I was, every single time the movie did something pretty interesting, it also did something that kind of undercut its interestingness, in my opinion, like, or that reminded me that this is a movie targeted at juveniles. Like there's like a campus rape joke in the movie that I just thought was extremely poor taste. Ugh. That I was like, maybe that would have been funny if I was like, you know, in middle school and it was like 20 years ago, you know, like, but it just, there's stuff that I'm just like, oof, like I'm really feeling the fact that this is not a movie that's for me. That said, I thought that the movie overall has enough new and interesting things that I would recommend it if you're interested in the concept of Groundhog Day in a horror movie. I will just say one other thing, and then we can get the spoilers, which is that you know, the whole time I was watching this, I was knowing Stephen Tobolowsky might be on this podcast with us, and I was thinking that like to compare Groundhog Day to this, because Groundhog Day is a movie that has stood the test of time. You know, regarded by many people as one of the best films of all time, certainly one of the best comedies of all time. And I was thinking, like, what is it that separates Groundhog Day from a movie like 1201? Have you guys seen 1201, the Jonathan Silverman?
No.
I have not.
Yeah. It's not a very good movie. It came out in 1993, and it's basically about this dude reliving his day. And, you know, I was thinking, like, what separates a movie like Groundhog Day from 1201 or from Happy Death Day? And I think the answer is, well, one of many reasons is that like the style that Groundhog Day is shot in is very classic, you know, whereas Happy Death Day, it is very much a movie of its time. Like the shooting techniques and the editing techniques, like there's a lot of Dutch angles and, you know, a lot of like CG and things that I think are going to horribly date the film in 10, 20 years that I think Groundhog Day doesn't really have. I mean, Groundhog Day has like technology from back then, but it's not like the style of the movie is very timeless, in my opinion.
Dave, just to your point, I think the filmmaking itself is a good point, but I think it's the least of what separates, in my mind, a classic like Groundhog Day from something like this.
Right. The script, clearly, right?
I think in particular with this formula, this idea, this concept, it's all about setups and payoffs, right? And the setups and payoffs in Groundhog Day are so wonderful. And the depth of the rabbit hole that Groundhog Day goes down, you know, the idea that Bill Murray is living this day thousands of times, mm-hmm. right? Infinitely. Like, he has been doing this so long that he feels like he's a god, right? Right.
He's mastered things. Yeah.
I think in our movie, Tree does it, what, 12 times, you know? It's like, it's a different scale. Right. And and I think it's an exploration mm-hmm. of a really attractive idea in Groundhog Day. Like, what would you do if you were immortal, had mm-hmm. infinite time, but were trapped in this horrible place? Yeah. Right.
It's a much more existential story, I think, right? Something that we could all apply and be like, man, this is deep. And
right, because in Groundhog Day, what you come to is ultimately it's about who we are and how we treat other people, right? That's what he comes to. He does everything else. He explores every other avenue. He becomes the wealthiest man. He steals the money from the truck. He gets all the women he could possibly want. He figures out how to say the right thing to any woman. He any other external id desire that he might mm-hmm. want to partake in, he figures it out, and nothing is good enough until he starts actually like being good to other people. And that is the only value that he finds from having immortality and infinite time, right? And I think that's a wonderful universal takeaway and what mm-hmm. makes a classic a classic. Here, none of that, right? None of that. There aren't themes that transcend like that. And I think that's what makes a classic a classic.
Mm. Well said, Jeff. Yeah, yeah. But let's talk more about Happy Death Day and spoilers. So let's get to spoilers for the film starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming.
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
I was going to jump on something Devendra said about the cast. I thought when you're in a film like this, a Groundhog Day type film, one of the big treats for an actor is being able to redo these scenes over and over again, making slight variations. And I thought the supporting cast in Happy Death Day was delightful. I thought all the different people in the movie just seem to have the best time in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Even the girl saving the world out front, even the guy with the sunglasses. There were so many pleasurable performances that I could see those people were relishing. And I thought that bravo to them. I just mm-hmm. wanted to say that.
Stephen, could you give us some insight about how that is generally shot? Like, do you just shoot all the variations in a row? You know, you come on your day and you shoot, you know, 14 different sunglass guy moments. Is that how it works?
I think I felt in Happy Death Day, they probably did just because of the budget. I was trying to look to see the various differences of the day in Groundhog Day. For example, Bill and I shot street scenes for a month.
Wow.
Depending on the weather conditions, we shot it for a month because the day had to be the same. Mm. And I had the feeling they filmed her walk from the dorm and the cavalcade of little trivial events that she sees at the beginning of that day. I felt they did it over and over and over again that day.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
They rehearsed it and they shot it all, and that was the cheapest way to do it.
The weather matches every time. It's amazing.
Yes, it's amazing.
But I do think you're right that the supporting cast does do a great job. Like, they sold the idea that every single day is the same, which, you know, isn't that hard because actors are used to doing the same thing over and over again. But you do feel it in this movie, especially when she wakes up with Carter there every single day. I was convinced that, you know, she was repeating the day, in fact.
Well, one of the things that bothers me about these movies sometimes is when you see the character wake up and then do something that clearly takes a significantly right. shorter amount of time
yep.
and then goes out and sees the exact same moments, you know?
Yep.
And that, I think that happened in this movie where there was a couple of times where she just busted out of that room and didn't dilly-dally and didn't ask for anything. And
right.
and yet and yet, you know, sunglasses guy was in the same position and all that stuff. So I was like,
well,
eh,
you
noticed, I don't know.
Well, you noticed that they were very careful to lay in various times in which the time did change.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
She got to her dorm room to say, oh, longest, you know, you're finally where her roommate says, oh, you're finally here. And it has her digital clock in the background. And at the first time she gets, you know, she says, oh, I'm late for class. At first it's 9:12. Then the next time she comes in, it's 9:20. Next time she comes in, it's 9:22. So they were careful with certain details in the background to say exactly what you're saying, that her time, she was trying to throw her time off, and they try to be true to that sort of through line at different parts of the movie. And the payoff for that was supposed to be, since this is spoilers, where she times the exact moment of when that blackout happens.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because that's when she notices exactly what time that blackout happens. And by having all the other times vary, that she notices it happened the same time each day when the power comes on in her room. So that was interesting that they really clung on to that idea.
Well, look, I'll say two things, that two moments in this movie that I felt really elevated it from like a decent horror movie to something that was, that gave me glimpses of greatness. One of them was the moment when she escapes from the hospital in the car. And she has this joyous moment in the car that's all done, I think, in like one shot, where she's celebrating that she did it. She made it out of there, and she's so happy. And then she gets pulled over by a cop, and then the cop gets killed out of nowhere in a genuinely shocking moment to me. Like, we knew that cop was going to die somehow, but I didn't know that it would happen quite like that. So I thought that was a wonderful moment, a great piece of acting by the main lead. And then secondly, I have to say, I admit, I did not see it coming that at the end of his day where she redeemed herself, that there was going to be another day. And when she wakes up that next day, it is a horrifying moment because you really do feel like, hey, she went through everything. She did the thing. She did the Bill Murray thing. She did everything she was supposed to do and still didn't get out of the day.
Which is what happens in Groundhog Day. Yeah.
That was the big surprise to me when that happened. And the way... But I have to say that I saw that coming from the beginning of the film as to who the killer was.
Oh, yeah.
And how did I see that coming? Why did I see that coming? Because this is spoilers, right?
Yeah. Spoilers.
Yes. Okay. Because her roommate was such a tall girl. if they had cast other tall women, but all the other women were like shrimps, and so she was the only tall girl. And I go, damn, that girl's tall. Oh, I bet you they're going to try to make her look like a guy. And I thought, you know,
like she needed to be someone that could plausibly be the killer. You're saying
yes, she had to be somebody big. She had to be somebody who had access to sharp instruments. So
this doesn't seem hard. Yeah,
go ahead.
They also kind of give us some clues early on, right? Once she starts trying to figure this out, I was like, oh, it has to be somebody who knows your birthday. It's like, oh, who have we seen so far in this movie? And also, like, every time she says happy birthday to the lead, it's there's a bit of creepiness to that performance that I think is either, I can't tell if it's just like they're trying to force that this character is up to something or they're just portraying it badly. I can't tell. But you could tell, there was something up there in that performance.
There was the thing that bothered me is the plan to give her a cupcake, which... Yeah. No one there supposedly eats cupcakes, and then they call that out at the end. It's like you can't just say the big plot hole and just say, "Oh, isn't it hilarious that we have a big plot hole here?" I don't know.
And doesn't anybody watch Forensic Files? I mean, if she is going to poison the cupcake, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to go in and check her stomach to see, oh, she ate strychnine. Oh, what did she just eat? Oh, a cupcake. Who the hell made this cupcake? Oh, you did. I mean, it's a slam dunk. But you know, it doesn't follow the regular rules of forensics. I mean, you would think she would do something more clever. But I did find, hey, here's something I really liked in the movie. I did find the fights enormously compelling.
Yeah.
I thought they were well staged. I thought they were, somebody once told me, when you do fights, whether on stage or in film, there's only two ways to do them. You have to fight dirty, and you have to go for the kill in every move. There could be no goofing around. I thought in the fight at the end, they were really going for it. I thought in all the fights in the hospital, they were really going for it. And this is something else Jessica can do that was very satisfying for me as an actress, is that some of the gotcha moments, the big gotcha moments for me is, unlike a lot of these, and I agree, it's not a slasher film, but a lot of these, she did not once trip on her shoes and fall. She's not going to be one of those women. And in almost every incarnation of this nightmare that she relives, she gives it to the killer. She either hits the killer in the head with a hammer, kicks the killer in the supposed nuts, if they were there, she gives it to him in more than one way. And in my audience of teenage girls and boys, they applauded wildly at these moments.
Yeah.
And that is something that Jessica really can do with her persona, is her anger and her passion in those fight scenes really carried the film, really made the day. And those fight scenes were very impressive.
Yeah, they were decently choreographed. I think there's definitely one moment on her supposedly good run, because this is sort of like a gamer who's trying to get their best run in the situation. But the point where she takes the cop, has a knife to the throat of a cop and then points a gun at him, like, that, I don't know if that's the best plan. Like, where do you go from here?
Well,
really?
I mean, she also somehow kicked her roommate out of a window to her death, and everybody believed her story about it.
Well, yeah. They do have the cupcake.
They got that cupcake,
Jeff.
Although she's right back at the diner, like right after that madness, and not at the police station for like hours.
Yeah. I don't know how real, you know, I got to be honest with you guys. I don't know how realistic the movie is.
I can't tell. Well, also that great run where after she pointed the gun at the cops and she successfully killed the killer or shot the killer several times, right? Cut to her back in her dorm. Because I guess that situation's all cleared up.
Yeah. Here's
something that kind of upset me. I'm thinking these people have never been in a hospital. The filmmakers have never been in a hospital. This is a note to the world. They don't turn the lights off at night in a hospital. Just because it's
empty.
Night,
yeah.
They don't turn the lights out. And they're filled with people, especially at night, because that's when people get hurt and are drunk and they come to hospitals. Unless, here is the point, unless, as you said, it's not a real hospital. And note to filmmakers, from my point of view, when you cross the line and announce to the audience that you're in a dream situation, like you have the not real hospital, you don't realize it, but you're removing jeopardy from the film. You remove real jeopardy from our heroine, and the only thing we have are either camera or sound assaults on our senses of things jumping out of the dark or loud noises, which make people jump but are very irritating, and it makes people not like your movie. So the thing is, there's more jeopardy attached if you keep the hospital real.
Well, here's another fact, though, Tobo. So I don't know how much you know about Blumhouse movies, but essentially the whole model there is rather than a big studio which makes, you know, five movies, each of which cost over $150 million, Blumhouse model is to make movies that are less than $5 million, but make like 30 of them, you know? And so this movie costs, I think, under $5 million. And there's probably a reason why they couldn't populate a hospital at night with tons of extras is because they didn't have enough money. And so they, you know, very often, and I'm sure you've encountered this having worked on a wide variety of projects, like you run into a situation where you can't
your reach exceeds your grasp in terms of the vision for the film, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. When I was leaving the film, a young man named Tommy Honton, who is a writer, he works in interactive theater, came running out of the audience and said, "I just wanted to tell you how much I liked you in Groundhog Day, and I couldn't believe you were watching this movie. What did you think?" And I said, "Well, can they do that?" And then he started explaining to me the Blumhouse formula.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And what he told me, and it was very clear, that they are very hip to the PG-13 formula, if you will. So there's never any nudity, never sex. They say vagina, which is okay to say, right? In the dorm room, they say yep. vagina. They say dickhead, which is okay to say. And she takes off her shirt, revealing her black bra in the first scene. So they front load that first scene with vagina, with dickhead, and her taking off her blouse. And then she leaves the room increasingly fast so the Asian roommate cannot really get vagina out. But we say vagina in our heads. So we think the film is far more risky than it is. But what Tommy was telling me is that when Blumhouse puts together their strategy, they target a specific audience. And he said this film, you could tell that they wanted to target every middle and high schooler in L.A. to see this film. And if they did that, they'd already be in profit. And from the size of the audience that I saw this with, I think they were successful.
Huh. Yeah.
I think it makes it the perfect movie for us to review.
I think it's going to be a big success, you know, financially. And it has a chance of making more money than, like I said, Blade Runner in the United States, which is crazy if you think about
it. It's hilarious.
They know what they're trying to target. They know how to do it. And they know how to do it at a very cheap price, which is in this case under $5 million. I'm glad that the filmmakers are going to do really well out of this, and I think the movie is certainly not a bad film.
Jeff? Yeah, I want to circle back around to my central point about setups and payoffs.
Please.
Because I felt like there was a few in this movie that were missed opportunities, and I guess you could say they were red herrings, specifically put in to throw you off the scent. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a little sloppy. Because there's clearly this big, big, big setup with the dad on the phone. And yes, she reconciles with the dad, but it feels like a side story, a side quest that she's on that doesn't really have anything to do with anything. And there was a sense of foreboding that she constantly misses his call, like almost like he's trying to warn her through the whole beginning of the movie. And she just doesn't listen to the phone ringing. None of that is paid off satisfactorily, in my opinion. Also, there's a big constantly leaving behind the bracelet, which you feel like is a setup for at one point not leaving behind the bracelet. But nothing is ever made of that bracelet other than the fact that he keeps bringing it to her at that moment. But I don't understand why she would continue to leave it behind when she knows that she's leaving it behind at a certain point, specifically in those early moments where she still doesn't like this guy. Why doesn't she ever pick up that bracelet on her way out? it's a setup without a payoff, and it feels sloppy, and I don't understand it.
I find it funny, Jeff, that these are the things you're pointing to, though, because there is a serial killer in this movie who comes out of nowhere and is apparently the guy who killed her mother. It's like once this stuff started happening in the movie, it's like, oh no, what is happening here?
Well, yeah, and he's laying on the hospital with a mask next to him for some reason, I guess.
Sure, the mask is around.
Well, no, her roommate brings it to him and puts it on his.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the flashback, the roommate puts it on his face and like kisses him on the mouth, which is like pretty creepy.
Jeff, it's all explained. It's all in there. But the serial killer thing, I had the sick feeling that oh no, this is what the movie is actually about. And when it turned out not to be just that, I was actually very happy because I didn't want this whole thing to be reduced to basically like a mystery thing that she has to solve and all, you know, she can be fine. What I did like about this movie is that it is all like it's actual payoff, like the whole thing about her avoiding her father's, her not confronting her mother's death, and they have that conversation. I think it's really well done. It comes out of nowhere in this movie, and I think it is a nice, humane conversation between a girl and her estranged father, and coming to terms with the fact that, you know, her mother isn't there anymore. So I actually appreciated all of that. And even though the roommate thing is kind of, it also feels like it comes out of left field, but I think that makes a lot more sense rather than having it be her solving the serial killer thing or getting revenge.
I agree. I was getting very upset, especially when the serial killer like immediately yep. pulled the mask off, and I was yep. like, oh, now that the audience knows, he's fine with the mask being off. But then it sort of makes sense. It's like, oh, I give you credit for he behaves differently yep. with the costume than the actual killer would.
Right.
Right. The biggest plot hole in this movie, by the way, is like they come up with this whole plan to like try to figure out who the serial killer is, and none of the plans is just restrain the serial killer and take off the mask. Just take yeah. off the mask. You're right. done. Movie over.
I had one thought, and I just don't know if you guys agreed with this, because I thought it was, of course, a goofy idea to call the school the Baylor Babies. You know, it was because you got to use the baby head, because we decided this head was going to be creepy, right. you know, which it wasn't, you know, was kind of goofy. But did any of you think the dad looked like the baby head?
Oh,
taking it next level. This is like cosmic brain stuff. Yeah,
because I'm looking at him and I'm thinking like, boy, he looks a lot like. Does that put together reality and dream? Is that the reason why the father is continually calling on the phone, and that parallels the repeated day and her repeated death? And then she sees the real father, and real father has a real baby head.
I think you're giving the movie too much credit, but I like it.
I don't know, but I did like the scene. I did like the scene, and that was the scene in which several people went out to get more popcorn. But I like that scene.
All right. Well, I think we can wrap it up there. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Stephen. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Find our theme song at adamwarrock.com. And stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. In the meantime, Stephen Tobolowsky, we can find more of your work on the Tobolowsky Files at tobolowskyfiles.com. Spell it for us, Stephen. How do you spell your name?
That would be S-T-E-P-H-E-N, T as in Tom, O B as in boy, L-O-W-S-K-Y, the Russian spelling. and you could, and if you go to StephenTobolowsky.com,
you know,
this
Stephen,
is a new webs.
Stephen, I don't know if you spelled that correctly.
T-O-B-O-L-O-W.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think you might have left out the second O. This has happened before.
Yeah.
It happened once. T-O-B-O-L-O-W-S-K-Y.
There you go. Yeah.
I spelled it correctly.
There you go. Yep.
If you go to StephenTobolowsky.com, not only are there links to the Tobolowsky Files and my two books, but also where I'm going to be on the book tour, because I'm going to be on a book tour through the Midwest and the East Coast and down in Florida. So check those places and dates. And if you're out there, come out and see me and say hello.
I have seen Stephen reading from his book live, and it is a great experience. So I'd recommend it at stephentobolowsky.com. Jeff Cannata, where can I find more of your work on the internet?
Oh, I do lots of shows. I don't have to go through all of them, but I will tell you, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I have jeffcannata.com too, also, which lists my shows.
How about you, Devendra Hardwar?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com. It's kind of hell week, so lots of reviews this week, so go check those out.
Yeah, find all my stuff at davechen.net. That's where you can keep track of what I'm up to. And next week, the Slash Filmcast will be discussing The Florida Project. Really amazing film. I haven't seen it yet. I've heard that it's one of the best of the year. So, that's what's going to be on the Slash Filmcast next week. Thanks for joining us on the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. We'll see you next week. We watch the movies, flicks, tracks for the good, bad. It's the Slash Filmcast for all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about.
This is Acast Recommends. Every week we pick one of our favorite shows, and this is one we think you're going to love.
Who exploded Vivian Stone? Was it Screen Hunk McSalad?
Mother's Digest called me dependably erotic.
Leading lady Joanna Shoebags.
Oh, you call me dramatic again, I will die!
First time director Wallace Byrne McTravers.
I think I'll just keep my clothes on for now.
Assistant director Laura Sidesalad.
If I can help you direct this film, I can certainly help direct your Winkler.
Technician James Wigington.
You've got a funny way of addressing a man holding a power drill.
Or someone else entirely. Listen in to find out who exploded Vivian Stone.
Acast is home to the biggest podcasts from the UK and around the world. Subscribe to this show and hundreds more now via Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.